Okay, so a part of this will be just about the mission itself, and part of it will be more general, and then we'll sort of close with what can be done in the future. Okay, as I'll show you, Planck was launched in May, and it's working incredibly well, in fact, better than we had expected, which is interesting. We had calibrated on the ground and expected certain photon loading in orbit, and things are a bit better than we thought on some of the instruments, slightly less so on some of the others, but it's actually working incredibly well. Okay, so part of this is an issue of much longer time scales, which I don't know if you're particularly interested beyond your time scale as a human, but I think our ultimate fate in the universe is something that we ought to at least be pondering. So hence the title. So there will be no ITP in the long term. Okay, so you are here, but you will not have 10 to the N grandchildren that will come after you.
You ever heard of Boltzmann brains?
Boltzmann brains. Now tell me about
KITP.
Boltzmann KITP brain. Yeah. I'm sure you'll find a way out of this dilemma. I have no doubt. You're very clever. And you will find a way out. Okay, so each of you is approximately a black body. And as you remember from thermodynamics, can is your light? Yeah, okay. So you remember this is the density in, you know, joules per cubic meter or whatever units, ergs per cubic centimeter that you like to use, per hertz. Okay, so this is the basic photon energy density. And when you have a telescope, let's say this is the universe out here somewhere. Okay. And here's Planck. Right, so radiation's coming in from all directions, of which we only really see in a particular direction with some responsivity. The telescope kind of looks like this. And there's a detector, and then eventually it's sent down to us. Okay. So if you actually calculate what ends up on the detectors, you have some energy density field, you have some flux, F of nu, which is C rho over 4 pi. Okay, so this ends up being sort of 8 pi's and 2 pi's. It's very nice. And even on the experimental side, we cancel them out. So they're 1. In this case, they're 2. Let's see. What did I do here? Is this C cubed here? By H nu cubed over C squared.
C is 1 for our
camera. Yeah, I know. But for me, it's not. So I have to be careful. I know you don't care about it, but it's embarrassing when we're off by, you know, 10 to the 10 or 10 to the 8 in delta T. It kind of makes a difference. Okay. So anyway, so this is the flux that we see, and this is sort of in watts per, say, square centimeter, per square meter, whatever, per hertz, okay, and then per steradian. So basically what you do, it ends up on the detector is a power P, which is the flux, basically times the bandwidth of the system, times the area, times the solid angle. And that's essentially what ends up on the detector, times some overall efficiency epsilon. For a single mode system like Planck, which is approximately single mode, oh, very clever. Okay. So the area of the telescope times the accepted angle is just lambda squared. And why is that? Because it's just diffraction theory. Okay, so the angle theta is approximately lambda over d, where d is the, say, diameter of the telescope. Right, so omega, which is approximately theta squared, goes like lambda squared over d squared. But the area A is d squared. Right, so hence A omega turns out to be lambda squared. This is what's called the antenna theorem. Okay, so Planck is approximately at the lower frequencies this, and so we end up with a power, which is A omega is lambda squared, which is C squared over nu squared, so we end up with approximately F nu beta C squared over nu squared times some efficiency epsilon. Okay. So this ultimately goes to a power P. See nicely the, where do you end up here? Okay, the C squareds cancel out just like you want it, they went away. Right, so you end up with 2H nu times, let's see, what do we have here? Beta times 1 over e to the H nu over KT minus 1. Okay? Now, so keep that in mind. So if you look at the Planck curve, if you have, say, f of nu versus nu, you know, rises, then it kind of falls again. Planck goes from, I'll do this in gigahertz, from 30 up to 857, which is way over here, almost a terahertz, about 900 gigahertz. Okay, so we span the peak of the spectrum quite nicely, which would be very important in a bit. Okay. So at low frequencies, so on this side, which we call the Rayleigh-Jeans side, where this is the mean side, at low frequencies, H nu is much, much less than KT. So e to the H nu over KT minus 1 is approximately, just expand the exponential, is approximately H nu over KT. Okay. So if you take that, shove it into here, you get this thing, which is H nu over KT, even H nu's go away, and you get 2 KT beta. Okay. Very simple, right? Even for string theorists, right, you can deal with it, okay? Okay, so, pardon?
Quality when there were so many approximate
sizes. Oh. Well, actually what I do to be a stickler is we call this thing T sub A and we shove everything into the effective temperature. Okay. But thank you, that's good. Someone's paying attention, you didn't fall asleep. That's good. Okay, so the two actually is here because you have two modes of polarization. And so for one mode, even though I use single mode, but I use it in different reference there. This is for two modes of polarization. So for one mode, one polarization state is just KT beta, which you probably know. Okay, so why is this important? So the number of photons, which is represented by the power, goes like the bandwidth. Okay. The temperature we have to deal with from the CMB. But what's going on here is if you plot antenna temperature, which is flux temperature, unfortunately being altitude limited here, I have to...
You don't need the screen.
You probably can't see this, right? No, I can't see it. Can I raise the screen? Okay. Means I have to turn off the. That's okay. It's good. That's good. All right. So if I plot T sub A, which is called the flux brightness, antenna temperature is all the same. So this is T sub A versus nu. What I get is something that looks like this. Okay. So where this is approximately 2.725 Kelvin. Okay, and then it drops at high frequencies. That's what's called the flux temperature. So the number of photons per unit time, say, on the detector is proportional to this T sub A. So it's basically equal to power divided by H nu. Okay, that's the number of photons per unit time. Okay, so why is this important? It's important because at high frequencies, this number begins to drop very significantly. Okay, so for example, at say 100 gigahertz, which will be very important shortly, T sub A, the flux temperature, is roughly 1 Kelvin. Okay, so it's already approximately a third of the background temperature, CMB background temperature. What we call T is called the thermodynamic temperature. So whereas this is called the flux temperature. This makes a big difference soon. Okay, so in terms of sensitivity, if we're photon statistics limited, then the sensitivity is going approximately like 1 over the square root of the number of photons. Okay, so what happens here is because the number of photons is going like the product of kT beta, it means the sensitivity, which I'll give in temperature, goes approximately like a temperature T divided by the square root of the bandwidth. Okay, because the number of photons is increasing as the bandwidth and the sensitivity is going down as 1 over the square root of the bandwidth. So if you're in what's called a photon statistics limited mode, which is also called a blip limit, for historical reasons, this means background limited infrared photometer, but is used more generally these days to refer to any device which is photon statistics limited, which, as you will see, Planck is very close to that. It's still called a blip limit. So let's just do a quick calculation. So what is T? So actually what you can do is you can use the fact that the antenna temperature is really the temperature which is giving you the photon number of photons. Okay. So this delta T then is appropriate for a T, which is the antenna temperature. So let me not worry about that too much, but let me say T goes from, say, 100 gigahertz to, say, 30. I'll do the higher frequency stuff in a moment. From 1 to approximately 3 Kelvin. Okay. So what is delta T? Okay, well, first of all, what is the bandwidth? Bandwidth is of the order of 10%. Let me see. 10 to 30%. And this is because we don't want to take too much of the bandwidth at one time because we want to distinguish between foregrounds and cosmological background. So typically, our bandwidth of acceptance is of order 10 to 30%. So if I do that, and I know that my base frequency is of the order of, say, 100 gigahertz or so, so that means my bandwidths are of the order of, say, 10 to 30 gigahertz, at least in the cosmological bands. And that's a good number to keep in mind for later. Okay. Right. So let's just do a quick calculation. Let's assume the beta is 10 gigahertz, just so we can scale from there, which is 10 to the 10th hertz. Okay, so delta T is going to be of order, let's do it for 3K at the moment, for the low frequency bands. 3K divided by the square root of 10 to the 10th, and that's nicely 10 to the 5th, so this is 30 microkelvin. Okay. Now, that's the actual temperature difference you measure in 1 second. So this is what's called the blip limit, as I mentioned, for the CMB. So you cannot do better than this for bandwidths, which are of order 10%. Okay, it's not possible, because you're limited actually by the CMB itself. You're not limited by the telescope, the detectors, or anything else. That's the fundamental photon statistics of the CMB. There's no way to do any better than that. Okay, in a second, we flew for more than a second, and for one detector, we have more than one detector. Okay, so the only way to do better more time, more detectors. And that's the only way around it. Okay. Is everyone okay?
Why did you choose 10%?
Oh, okay. So again, I'll show you in a moment there are many things that we have to worry about besides the CMB. We would much rather have an extragalactic mission. We applied for an orbit which was outside our galaxy, and we were told that no, we could not do that, okay, at the current time. So we have to live inside our galaxy, unfortunately. And we also applied for one which was at a much higher redshift, and they said, no, you can't do that either. We don't know how to do that. So we have to live with galaxies between us and the CMB. It's a real problem, but, you know, whatever, got to deal with it. So the 10 to 30% is because we have to deal with these many backgrounds, such as the synchrotron radiation from our galaxy. Are there electrons in the galaxy spiraling because of magnetic fields? There's old physical review letters. Remember those things from years ago before the internet that people threw out into space and they formed dust? Okay, so there's debris out in space. And those we will see give us problems. So if I were on the same plot to look at other kinds of backgrounds, I would see something like the following. I would see synchrotron radiation, which is, say, spiraling electrons in a galaxy coming down, and I would see dust coming up. And as I'll show you some pictures. These are massive problems now. On COBE, we just basically said, We cut out the galaxy within about 15 degrees, and that was actually good enough, right? But I'll show you in a bit. One day on Planck is worth 100 years on COBE. Okay, I'll show you some other comparisons shortly. So the reason we don't choose a huge portion of bandwidth is because if we did, we could not distinguish the dust, synchrotron, and other backgrounds, radio galaxies, dusty galaxies, from the cosmological background. Okay. So you're right. You could make this number smaller. You can't do anything about this right now. You could wait. Okay. But of course, that really doesn't help you anyway, because it's a contrast ratio. But you could increase that, but you don't want to increase that. Okay. Does that make sense? Okay. So that ends that section screen. Okay, so just to do it in your head, suppose you integrate for a year and you have the blip limit, which you all know is now around 30 microkelvin in a second. You know the year is about, I use pi as actually not being equal to 1, but it's about pi times 10 to the 7th, so about 30 million seconds in a year. And so you take the square root of 30 million, which is, let's see what's easier to use, 30 million, okay, take square root of 30 million, you get square root of a million is 1,000, and the square root of 30 is about 5.5. So 1 year seconds, it's the square root of tau is roughly 5 times 10 to the third. So your delta T then goes in 1 year down to 30 microkelvin divided by 5 times 10 to the 3, and it goes down to about 6 nanokelvin. So in 1 year with Planck, which we now have about 7 months on the CMB data, we have some coasting out to orbit data as well. But in a year, we could get down to sort of a unit of a metric of around a few nanokelvin. Okay, well, that's pretty small. And then we have multiple detectors. So if you want to compute, you know, at low L, what the limit of, say, a B mode detection might be, theoretically, you can get it right from here. So, you know, we're already at the low L limits of around, you know, nanokelvins. So those are pretty small numbers. However, there's crap out there, unfortunately. Okay. And there's also Microsoft, which likely won't exist in the future either. Okay. So I'll show you some pictures because I can't draw them on the board. So as you know, I mean, what you guys do for a living is you take your hands, you wave them at the board, and you come up with these things, okay? Which is probably what this workshop is all about, right? You wave your hands, splat it on the board. Out comes inflation and space-time foam and all the other cool stuff that I used to love. Actually, I started life as a field theorist, but somehow went to the dark side. So I still have empathy for you. Okay, so as far as we can tell, the universe is on the order of 14 billion years old. We think the first thermonuclear things started, a couple hundred million years after the Big Bang. We still don't know. And there's what we call the dark ages in between the surface of the last scattering, which is currently thought to be around 400,000 years after the Big Bang, and the turn on of the first thermonuclear things. Now, it doesn't take a string theorist to understand that if you're burning something in thermonuclear devices, like stars, that eventually the fuel goes away. Right. So you don't have to be too profound to realize that in the long run, we're doomed, which is nice. Okay, but that's only one doom. The other doom is actually much worse. So whatever, I mean, you've all seen this crap, right? No one believes it's garbage anyway. Pardon?
Can you explain the
quantum
gravity?
Yeah. I was hoping you guys would tell me what that is. Yeah, whatever. I mean, we spend our time making pretty pictures because we can't understand what you guys do. So. Right, so those of you that are into domination, I know that's partly what you do over here in the off hours. Sometime around 5 to 10,000 years after the Big Bang, we transition between photon and matter domination. Around that time. That's actually an interesting number to know. The current photon to baryon ratio, which is important, is around a billion or so. Okay. Recombination happens around 400,000 years after the Big Bang. And this whole area of galaxy formation is actually of quite some interest to many of us, which is how do structures form in the universe and why do they form? Which, of course, is very important if you study, think about dark matter and other seeds of galaxy formation. Okay, we think there's a peak in star formation around 3 billion years after the Big Bang. And then the really bad news is, of course, this stuff called dark energy, which, whatever it is, it's a cool name. We don't know what it is. Maybe you guys figured it out in this workshop, but if you have, please let me know. And then the ITP up here, KITP. All right, you've all seen this plot, so I won't bore you. You've all seen this. So in the beginning, the temperature is very hot. In fact, one metric we often tell our students about is if you take 1 second after the Big Bang, it's about 10 to the 10th Kelvin, which is approximately 1 MeV, which is approximately the electron-positron annihilation energy. So after 1 second, you cease, approximately cease producing electron-positrons, and then you go into more classical nucleosynthesis. Yeah, whatever. I mean, you know all this crap, so. All right, formation of galaxies somewhere out here. Recombination, which is not correct here in this plot, which I cheesily stole off the internet. This is not correct. Recombination and matter, radiation domination, are not identical. Okay, so at the current time, it appears as though the so-called dark sector, which is a combination of dark energy and dark matter, is about 96% of the mass energy density universe, and the periodic table is around 4%. However, that was not true in the past. If we understand what dark energy is, which we don't, but if we make some simple assumptions, then in the past, dark energy was a very tiny fraction of the mass energy equation. And in fact, dark matter dominates in the past, and atoms become even more significant. Photons obviously become quite significant, and even neutrinos become quite significant. But dark energy is not. Okay. Well, there's lots of other things out there in the universe, and while you just want the bottom line, which is, you know, okay, tell me did inflation happen, and tell me what the inflaton energy is. So, good question. Okay, but there are lots of things between us and that answer, and unfortunately, some of them are going to be very annoying. There are lots of thermonuclear things that light up dust. And in particular, there are things that are called submillimeter galaxies. And they tend to peak. This is sort of flux as a function of frequency. So here's 10 to the 12, which is a bit higher. This is 1,000 gigahertz. But even down here at 100 gigahertz, these things begin to rise. Okay, so these become very, very annoying things that we have to deal with. And this is just one class of structures that are important. These are submillimeter galaxies, which are, in their own right, very interesting. And they peak around a terahertz, which is 100 microns in wavelength, 300 microns, excuse me. And this happens to be in a region where the atmosphere from the ground is basically completely opaque. It's like the ultraviolet side of the atmosphere, which is completely opaque, which is nice because you live because of that. This, on the other hand, is due to molecular transitions in oxygen, water is a biggie. And so we really can't see through the atmosphere very well. We're trying with things like SCUBA on ground-based telescopes. If you want to do this well, you have to go out into space, or at least on a balloon. I'm not going to discuss that in too much detail, except to tell you that there's a lot of stuff which you might want to take a look at in terms of its interest. In spectroscopy in this range, which Planck does not do, but Herschel does, and I'll show you in a moment, Herschel and Planck were launched together, and there are line emissions that one could look at to study these galaxies, early galaxies. Okay, I'm not going to do too much with that.
So if you have a model of these fermions and then you try and test it first with your data,
yeah, well, it turns out this is not such a big issue for Planck. This is 100 gigahertz here. Our bands go up to a terahertz. So it's not trivial, but our highest frequency bands are really more for looking at dust. But dusty galaxies come into play. In fact, I'll show you shortly, and we're going to be releasing soon a survey of dusty galaxies. So these kind of structures are fascinating because it's probably one of the best ways to look at very early structures. But the right way to do this is not via Planck. It's more like Herschel, but it's not Herschel. It's something that allows you to do very fine spectroscopy at very, very low limits. And we don't have an instrument up there to do that, but this someday, hopefully, we'll have an instrument to do this. I just wanted to give you a taste of things we're going to have to deal with, even in Planck, but we'll have to deal with them in a fairly general way. Okay. So Planck goes from about 30 gigahertz, and these numbers are off a little bit. Here's 10, 20, here's 30. This band's actually, this is 30 all the way up to 900 gigahertz. So here's a terahertz right here. These are the centers of the bands. The reason these numbers are given to three significant digits is just the center of the band. Okay. So if you look at this plot, which is flux temperature, so it says brightness temperature, remember the antenna temperature we talked about, brightness temperature in microkelvins versus frequency in gigahertz, you see the CMB, antenna temperature dropping off, like we talked about, and you see things called total galaxy fluctuations. So now this is really a kind of a plot of delta T over T, well, delta T, sorry. So here's the low order fluctuations that we found on with COBE. And here are other things which contribute. The galaxy contributes fluctuations from synchrotron radiation primarily at low frequencies, Bremsstrahlung. And then at high frequencies, we have dust. Well, dust tends to rise with frequency for two reasons. First of all, it has an effective temperature, typically of order 20 Kelvin or so. That's, for example, the starlight. If you take starlight and you dump it on dust, and dust is basically debris that coalesces into small particles. We don't know exactly the size of them, but we think they're on the order of sort of microns to tens of micron scale, and some smaller. But you light them up with starlight, they heat up, and then they radiate in the far infrared. That increases with frequency for two reasons. First of all, the size of the particles is small compared to the wavelength. So 100 gigahertz is 3 millimeters wavelength. These particles are tiny. So if you remember anything about scattering theory, you remember that the scattering efficiency for small particles goes up roughly as 1 over the size to the fourth power. Okay, now it's not exactly that here, but it's a contributor. The other fact is that the flux is rising with temperature because these things peak way over here at 20 Kelvin. The peak is way over here, not over here. So there's two effects that cause this to rise. In any case, the dust spectrum is rising with frequency. The synchrotron and Bremsstrahlung spectrum are dropping with frequency. So there is a trough somewhere in this region. This is actually around 70 gigahertz. Say the nice bands are between 40 and 100 and some gigahertz, where you can map out this trough and look at the cosmological backgrounds in great detail. With COBE, this wasn't an issue, wasn't very much of an issue. As long as we cut out the galactic plane, with WMAP, it's more of an issue. And with Planck, it's a huge issue. Okay, hence the wider frequency coverage with Planck.
How well is the linear behavior of the dust understood? For example, that's a pretty large range of scales, and so I could easily imagine that you can understand the linearity well above the CMB part. How do you disentangle it?
We don't. I mean, this is just, you know, a cartoon model of what it looks like. The synchrotron, we have at least decent models for because of cosmic ray spectra. And we can map out the magnetic field a little bit from starlight polarization, which also interacts with dust grains. Dust is actually less well understood. We have some measurements. And you know, one of the things we're going to get with Planck is a really good measurement of this. You'd like a nice theoretical model of this, and we don't have that. People have tried that, and the problem is that the space is a pretty good vacuum, and it's hard actually to duplicate in the lab as good a vacuum as you have in space. Even with the best vacuum pumps you know, technologies that we have in say the clean room nearby. It's very difficult to get to those vacuum levels. That's actually not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is that the mean free path between collisions to form these things is huge. And so simulating that in laboratory is very difficult. Nonetheless, people do measurements where they basically burn things to try to produce soot. The closest analogy to dust in space is really soot. If you take a candle and you burn it, you get small dust carbon grains coming off it. And that's not a bad analogy. But of course, that's not how dust in space forms. The thought is that dust in space forms by collisions and that there's accretion into very small particles. The exact mechanism is not well understood at all. It's not just carbon, it's probably silicates and maybe even, you know, some other, maybe hydrocarbons, something we don't know. There's a very significant amount of work needs to go into understanding dust, and for some people this is their career, is understanding dust. For us, you know, it's like we'd rather not deal with it, but we have to. Okay, so I'll run quickly through some stuff and then we'll get right into Planck. You know, if you take COBE, you get this beautiful, amazing spectrum. This still impresses me every time I look at it. This is 400 sigma error bars. That's just amazing. And if you look at the delta T sky, with our one of our best bands on COBE was 53 gigahertz, and you take it from zero to roughly 3 Kelvin, you don't, of course, see much. But I'll come back to this in a second. When you blow it up, you do see. So I wanted to show you a couple things because this is going to be important for discussions you have on B modes and when we talk about B modes. This is attenuation in the atmosphere in dB. So 10 dB is a factor of 10. 100 dB is a factor of basically 10 to the 10th, okay? And 1,000 dB is 10 to the 100. So these are pretty big numbers, attenuations, okay? This is the exponent, and this is a function of frequency. So this is frequency in hertz. So here's 10 gigahertz, here's 100 gigahertz, here's a terahertz. So Planck is measuring in this region. From the ground, which Planck, I don't know if you realize this, Planck's not on the ground, okay? I don't know if I made that clear, that if you were to sit on the ground, you just get killed for some things. And if you look at this in particular, you can see studying dust and submillimeter galaxies from the ground is really hard because of all these transitions. So water vapor, because there's a large dipole moment, it's a huge problem. O2 is a big problem. O3, which you don't show here, and then at higher frequencies, things like CO2 and other hydrocarbons. At very low frequencies, if you want to study 21 centimeter from the early universe, the ionosphere becomes a problem. There's a nice patch between, say, 100 megahertz and, you know, order 10 gigahertz or so, which is very clear. And then remarkably, if you like remarkable things, it's nice that human vision actually lies in a region where you can see out through the atmosphere. I don't know if you're into, quote, you know, coincidences, but this is just beautiful. When I teach optics and I have my students study this edge here, you know, the fact that you're alive because of transitions in ozone and water vapor and oxygen, this is just amazing. This edge goes from almost, you know, almost zero to just, look, that's 1,000 dB attenuation over an extraordinarily narrow range, right around 300 nanometers. This is the ultraviolet cutoff of the atmosphere. Just phenomenal. Okay. Anyway, so we can see through the sky for optical telescopes. And we can see through the sky pretty well in the microwave regime. As we begin to climb up into the important cosmological bands, it's harder. It's not impossible, it's harder. And so we have to take, it's a lot more difficult. You have to be very, very careful when you do this. Nonetheless, we do.
So there are these ground or balloon based experiments.
Yeah.
Remind us how they deal with this.
Yeah, well, I make my living in that. There's, let me show you another plot in a moment, which will help clarify that. Okay. If one of the best reasons to go to the moon in my opinion, is, you know, so you can hang out in the vacuum on the moon, preferably with a spacesuit on, and you don't have to deal with this stuff. It's a great place to do science. But if I blow this up and I look at antenna temperature as a function of frequency, now I've concentrated on sort of the CMB bands from 10 gigahertz to 500 gigahertz. And it's a very busy plot, but you can follow it pretty quickly. Here's the CMB, right? Here's 1 Kelvin, so here's 3 Kelvin dropping, okay? Here's the atmosphere at, here's 4 kilometers. So this would be from a mountain or from the South Pole. So 4 kilometers is around 13,000 feet. And here's, what do I have? Here's 15 kilometers. Okay, so one of the uses of a Predator or a drone aircraft is to blow up people. The other is to do cosmology with. You probably didn't realize this, but the CIA has a big program in cosmology. So you think it's called the Central Intelligence Agency? It's not. It's a cosmology intelligence agency. So while they're doing things going down, they're also looking up.
A fraction of their budget?
That's classified. Okay, so let's look at the scale here. Here's 3 Kelvin. Here's a tenth of a Kelvin. Now, as you go up in frequency, remember the quote, really good bands are, say, between, I don't know, 30 and, say, 200 gigahertz in the CMB. You see all kinds of nasty things in the atmosphere, and particularly you see this really nasty peak right here, right around 60 gigahertz. And this is actually due to oxygen vibrational, and there's a combination of rotation vibrational bands that exist in oxygen, which are incredibly nasty. So even at, what do I have here, at 35 kilometers, which is where we fly in a balloon, so about 100 to 130,000 feet, the atmosphere, while it drops down very low, this is 1 millikelvin, this is 100 microkelvin, drops down here, it's extremely low. It's almost as good as being in space. Still, if you try to operate in this regime around 60 gigahertz or so, you're basically in an almost impossible situation. So on a balloon, you basically just cut it here, you ignore this region, then you start up again here. But even on a balloon, you'll see a lot of different transitions. These are things like ozone, oxygen, water vapor transitions, which become very narrow because pressure broadening is much less. Sure. Right.
Don't you want that to be, you're saying when it's low, that's good?
Yeah.
I'm confused.
I'd like zero, but I'll take 10 to my 6. So this is...
You're talking about stuff not getting through to us.
Right, so I flipped the scale slightly. Let me go back. One. So here I have attenuation through the atmosphere. So low is good. Okay. This is basically opacity. Now what I flip to is more or less transmission through the atmosphere, which would be the inverse of that. Okay. But not quite, because I'm actually showing you the effective temperature of the atmosphere. So I could spend a whole hour on this just alone, because there's a lot of issues related to the CMB versus the quantum limit of detectors versus the atmospheric emission. But the only thing I want you to take away from this is that the atmosphere is a serious issue that you have to contend with on the ground, even from a mountain or the South Pole. From a balloon, it's much less of an issue. Much less so that in some selected bands, for example, if you hang out here, which is a pretty good band, here to here, it can be very small if you could stay within this region. You could be in the millikelvin of the atmosphere, which is tiny and small enough. If you want to talk about details, I'm more than happy to engage you on this. The quantum limit, which is effective temperature of detectors in their photon statistics limit, is rising with frequency. But it's still comparable to CMB. So remember we said that the blip limit of detectors is actually limited by the CMB now for the best detectors we have. Okay. So you can see that quantum limit is actually rising above the CMB temperature. Now, if you want to talk about why you can be blip limited when the quantum limit is higher, this depends on phase coherence in the detector versus a bolometer, which is not a phase coherent device. So it's basically a trade-off between measuring phase and not measuring phase. Okay. In one case, you measure number of photons well. In the other case, you resolve both the phase and the photon number. Okay. In detail, we'll worry about it in a moment. These are then the fluctuation levels of synchrotron H2, which is bremsstrahlen, dust coming up. And then there are extragalactic sources. There are galaxies out there, and these are the fluctuation levels approximately from galaxy. This is delta T over T at the 10 to the minus 5 level. So these are the primordial fluctuations. Okay, and again, they drop because we're doing this in antenna temperature.
Sorry, is that delta T over T times 10 to the 5, or that label shouldn't?
This is delta T. Okay, this is 10 microkelvin, this is 30 microkelvin. Yeah, this is, yeah, it's wrong, thank you. Okay, so it's complicated, but it looks more complicated than it really is. What surprised us is that when we first went to the South Pole back in the late 80s, there was concern that you would be killed by the atmosphere, because the atmosphere, first of all, is larger than the CMB, and you're trying to get to things which are not the atmosphere limit, but you're trying to get way, way down here. We didn't know how far down we have to go. So there's concern is, can you drive this down by six orders of magnitude? And the answer was apparently yes, well, because that's what we did. But it's very scale dependent. So if you try to drive the atmosphere down on large angular scales, if you're doing something like this on the sky, it's much harder to do than if you're doing something like that. So there's a scale dependence of how well you can drive the atmosphere down, which becomes an issue when you start talking about...
When you say drive it down,
well,
do you mean model it and subtract it, or do you mean...
We don't model it.
Small.
Yeah, it's not even small. It's just... We're looking through the atmosphere. So if I'm comparing, say, two parts of the sky here and here, if I'm switching back and forth between two parts, what happens is I'm still looking through many kelvins of atmosphere, say 10 kelvin of atmosphere, and I'm trying to measure a temperature difference at the microkelvin level. So to any rational person, they would say subtracting two numbers, which are 10 million microkelvin to one, is stupid, right? I mean, you'd have to be insane to do that. But we did it. So... Okay, well, you can say we're insane, which is fine. But it does work at some level. And how well it works is a function of the angular scale. If I do this now, rather than this, I get in much more trouble.
So the fluctuations in the atmosphere, in other words, are...
They're angular dependent, and of course, they're time dependent. Right? It's a very nasty and complicated mess. Okay, this is transmission of the atmosphere from a very good mountaintop site, just to show you, because some of this will be important. This is now transmission in fraction, so one is 100% transmission. Zero is completely opaque. And this is for, again, a very good site. You can see that this is wavelength in microns, so this is 1 millimeter here. So in the CMB bands, which are right in here, it's pretty good. You know, you're kind of 90%. And then you have these troughs you have to worry about. When you try to study galaxies in the submillimeter, you have a very difficult time. And it's not just the absolute level of transmission, it's the fluctuations. Okay, you've all seen the beautiful work on supernova, where it looks like we have a cosmological term. Won't dwell on that too much, but except to say that, unfortunately, this is really fun to do, but it's very bad news. And looks like, you know, life is going to be nothing but a passing fad. Okay, well, you've all seen this. I mean, the reason this works as a way of using geometry to measure density is because the average distance between galaxies changes as a function of the total matter density. Okay, I would be much happier personally if we lived in a closed universe. Just philosophically, I find that much more appealing. And I don't know who designed this one, but I would like a recall, frankly. Okay. So, with COBE, we measured the very large scale fluctuations. And with ground-based experiments, actually at the same time, we measured the small scale fluctuations. We couldn't do the large scale from the ground, and COBE couldn't do the small scale from altitude because the optics were too small. When we put them together in 1992, it sort of all came together, and we measured the first power spectrum. Okay, anyway, we already saw this. Okay, so as you probably deal with in your workshop, you know, the really big issues here for you are the cosmological term. I don't know if you're dealing with dark matter here, but we have to worry about the baryonic term. The radiation term is small. This is huge, and this is huge. Okay, so gotta know who your friends are. So dark matter sucks, literally. But it's your friend, right? Because you exist because of dark matter. Without it, you wouldn't exist. Literally, that's where structures come from, right? You suck, right? Right? Dark energy, on the other hand, blows, right? Literally. And it's your enemy. So make sure you know that when you leave here, okay? So life will be extinguished because of that.
So aren't you waving your hands about the far future discussion?
Me? I'm on furlough. This is my furlough day. Okay. Yeah, I'm waving my hands. I hope you'll tell me. If you want to buy it, Jamie, you have universal life insurance. Anybody here buy universal life insurance? You can buy universal life insurance. They think it's one thing, but really, you know, got serious men, right? This is, buy life insurance in the universe. Good investment, right? Unfortunately, you won't be able to collect. All right, just a bunch of pretty pictures. All right, so hopefully you'll tell me what space-time foam is, right? And then how to make nice cartoons like this, right? And tell me about inflation, and I want to know. Quarry minds want to know. Well, things that we can calculate and make pretty pictures of are things like baryogenesis, to some extent, and nucleosynthesis, which we feel are in very good shape, right? Because we can study that in the laboratory. In fact, if you think of how far back do you go with the LHC? So, does anyone know? So the LHC goes to what, 10 TeV? 10 TeV.
One.
No. Isn't it 10?
LHC, 7 TeV right now.
It's what?
7 TeV.
Yeah, I think it's around 10, yeah, roughly.
Right. 14 in 3 years.
You argue, I can't believe it, right? Pi is 1, E is 1, right? C is 1, and you argue about 7 versus 12? Now we know where you're real, you know, what's really important to you. Okay, so 1 second is an MeV, and it scales like, you know, T to the 1/2. So what is it then at 10 to the 12th, which is a million times higher than 1 MeV? I mean, you can do math better than I can, right? Okay, so how many seconds back is that? It's 10 to the 6th squared. It's 10 minus 12 seconds, right? So you're getting back the first picosecond in a TeV, right? Do that right? Yeah. Yep, okay. So 10 TeV, go back to 100 times smaller, right? So 10 femtoseconds. Okay, so we think in laboratory, we understand back to 10 femtoseconds. That's pretty impressive to me. I don't know if you believe it. So we're studying 10 femtoseconds. As you know, if you study, if you do nucleosynthesis calculations, which I don't do, but I can certainly see what other people have done, the nucleosynthesis is very sensitive to the part which is cut off on the bottom here, which is the, this is the photon to proton ratio. So here's a billion, here's 10 billion. Okay, so the yellow band here is roughly where we think we are. And by studying the various elements, the ratio of helium to hydrogen, deuterium to hydrogen, helium-3 to hydrogen, lithium, et cetera, we get a nice handle on understanding the photon to baryon ratio, a very important number to know. Planck does not do that. Okay, so we're working our way forward. So from first few minutes to a few hundred thousand years, we go from ionized to neutral. So we go from Thomson scattering, free electron scattering, to bound scattering, Rayleigh scattering. So we go more or less from a short mean-free path to a long mean-free path, so we say we go from opaque to clear. All right, so suddenly the CMB pops out and we can see it. Then what happens is, after that, sort of the universe just doesn't do much as far as we can tell. From about 400,000 to 400 million years, when the first things light up in terms of thermonuclear fusion, this era is called the Dark Ages. Okay, the universe is largely neutral, but we don't have any structures yet. Okay, so dark matter collapse, baryonic collapse in progress, and you get this, you know, meaningless picture. But okay, then at a few hundred million years after the Big Bang, first stars, we think reionized universe, and see so these nice simulations. In this case, due to CRD, of looking at bubbles as structures begin to form. So this is very important if you study 21 centimeter radiation. You get these beautiful bubbles forming and reionizing the universe. Again, simulations. Hopefully we'll know the next decade what this looks like. Then if I go forward even further, so this is 940 million years. This is the Via Lactea simulation, so it's an n-body simulation. So these are really beautiful to look at. This is 6.2, z of 6.2, and you can just kind of work it forward. This is 3.7, this is about 2 billion years. And you can see these beautiful structures forming as dark matter and baryonic matter begin to form these very deep structures. 10 billion years, and then finally today. Okay, so people do these kind of simulations, and then we have these pictures like the HST picture, where you actually see what appear to be reasonable correlations with structures. Okay, and then ultimately, solar systems and structures form, and then life begins. Okay, whatever, don't need that. Okay, so this is where you came. I'm not sure why you came, but probably came for the food afterwards. So with COBE, we measured with an angular scale of about 7 degrees. Okay, so if you hold your hand at arm's length when you're fighting over your latest string theory simulations, that's about 7 degrees. So, okay. WMAP was much better and actually went down to a order, a third of a degree or so, or a little better. With Planck, we go down to about 5 arc minutes, about a 12th of a degree. Okay, so these are just rough simulations of showing the effect of the beam size. Large beam size, where we saw the primordial WMAP, which did a beautiful job showing the horizon scales and a bit beyond the sub-horizon scales. And then Planck, which is just going to do a killer job, is even better. Okay, so this is just various pictures to prove that we didn't, it's not like the moon mission where it was all done in, you know, in the studio, although I'm sure there's a conspiracy theory out there right now saying that all of these missions are actually just done in Hollywood. Maybe right, I don't know. Okay, but we built stuff. Took a long time, about 15 years. Finally, in May.
So what is the epsilon factor for Planck then?
Yeah, okay. So for every photon that hits the front of the mirror, so go back. Oops, not there yet. So for every photon that hits the front of the mirror and then ends up, here's the detector focal plane array, it has to go through a couple things first. Luckily, there are no big windows because we're up in space, so we don't need windows. There's one mirror. There's a second mirror down here, which you can't really see. Here's the mirror again. I'll show it in better detail shortly. And then it ends up in the detector. So there's about a little less than 1% loss here, a little less than 1% loss here. And then when you get to here, there's a fairly significant loss going from the front of the focal plane onto the bolometer, or onto the detector. There's several types of detectors here. That turns out to be of order of 50% loss. So you lose about half the photons or more, actually more than that, by the time they actually get dumped on the detector and absorbed by the detector. So what is this number? For you, of course, doesn't make any difference. It's one. But for us, it's like, you know, 0.37 or something like that, depending on the detector. But it's a order unity. And of course, since the sensitivity goes like the square root of the number of photons, if you lose half the photons, you only increase the noise by root 2. So, you know, in a pretty gutsy move, ESA dumped two missions, one on top of the other, so they could blow them both up at once, put it on Ariane 5, lit the fuse, and then walked away.
Did you go to lunch?
I did not. No, I watched. So it was a beautiful launch. Actually, everything went extremely well. They actually separated, which would just be a bummer if they didn't. And then they get shoved into a L2 orbit, which is the second Lagrange point in a sort of fairly complex and big orbit. This is in 10 to the fifth kilometers. So this is kind of what the orbit looks like. It's not a stable orbit, but it's good enough for us. Okay, so it's at L2 now, as is Herschel. You know, they're not going to hit each other. So the instrument basically is a primary mirror, which is roughly person size. It's about 1.7 meters. Okay. There's a shield to shield from some stray light from the sun and the Earth. So the sun and the Earth are back here. The instrument sort of spins around this axis, and then it sweeps out, as I'll show you in a moment. And there's all kinds of gizmos on board to make sure it actually works. This was taken a few days before the launch. It's actually pretty enough to actually see the reflection in the mirror. Here's the focal plane array here. Here's the detectors here and here. This is the primary mirror, and then there's a secondary mirror, which you can't really see there. Okay, and then there's all kinds of stuff that you may or may not care about, but it's kind of important. And then the whole thing spins about this axis at about 1 RPM. This is what it looks like, again, not too long before launch. This is in a chamber to measure its radiometric properties as well as sensitivity to the transmitter. And I said it's about 1.7 meters approximately. And here you can see a person for scale. If you're into the specifics, it's what's called an off-axis Gregorian telescope. It has an elliptical secondary and a parabolic primary. And here's the focal plane back here. Okay, here's the focal plane in some detail. There's two types of detectors on board. This is the bolometer section, which is cooled to 100 millikelvin in temperature. And then these are the low-frequency total power detectors, which are transistor-based detectors, also cooled, but to about 20 Kelvin. So the bolometers are cooled to 100 millikelvin, which with a dilution refrigerator. I'll tell you a story about that in a second. We should get about 2 to 3 years worth of life out of that. The so-called NEP, the noise equivalent power, is about 10 attawatts per hertz, approximately. So an attawatt is 10 minus 18 watts. That's the HFI receiver. The LFI receivers are a couple times the quantum limit, and they have noise temperatures around 5 to 10 Kelvin, so a few times the CMB. All right, so it's very low background detector system, and the mirrors, again, are very high reflectivity, so, or 99% or so reflectivity. So I don't know if you're into Lagrange points, whatever your fetish is, but this is what it looks like as the Earth and the Moon go around the Sun. This is L2, so we're here. So we go around basically once per year. Okay. Yeah, whatever. Okay. So here's the sun here, and then we're about 1.5 million kilometers out at L2. All right, the moon is going around the Earth here, and then we follow the orbit of the Earth around the sun at L2. And then we rotate at L2, You can see a little picture here. Here's the bore side of the instrument. This is the beam pointing direction. And we rotate about this axis. Here's the sun instrument axis. We rotate about this axis. Okay? At about very close to 1 RPM. We have some control over that, which will be important for the future. There's a whole lot of stuff on board to make sure it works. And for those of us who worked on it, it's frankly amazing that it does work because it's so complicated in terms of the cryogenic system. There is a passive passive system which just radiates out to space. That's a no-brainer. But then there is a hydrogen sorption cooler which cools at 20 Kelvin, a closed cycle 4 Kelvin cooler, which we were all terrified of, and then a dilution refrigerator, which is even more frightening. And they all have to work together. If any one of them dies, most of the instrument dies with it. So far, everything's worked, which is quite incredible. We have 36,000 liters of helium-3 on board. I don't know if any of you follow, you missed a great opportunity for investment. The price of helium-3 went up a factor 10 in a very short period of time. Does anyone know the story of this? It's quite interesting. You could have made a killing, literally. I mean, you could have just made it. You could have retired from string theory and actually become an administrator or something. Or bought your own ITP. So the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, found out that helium-3 makes a great neutron detector, and they want to detect nuclear weapons that might be coming into the country illegally. You have to have an import license, by the way, to bring in nuclear weapons. Okay. If you ever tried to buy one on eBay, see, it's difficult. And so they bought up all the helium-3 that they could find. The price literally went up by a factor 10. So there's an incredible store of helium-3 out at L2. Many, many, many millions of dollars worth now. If you want to get it, it's free. Just get it, okay? It's just being thrown away in space. Just gets exhausted in space. Okay, anyway, that's enough for about 2.5 years at the current rate. Once that's gone, the bolometer shut down. There's no possibility of going beyond that. The stability instrument is around 10 microkelvin at 20 Kelvin and 20 nanokelvin at 100 millikelvin. So it's more than sufficient for the detectors. Whatever, this is just plots to show that the temperature drops. This is the temperature of the detector at launch. It's around room temperature. And then it ends up at about 40 days, down here around 30 Kelvin. And then it keeps going on from there, drops very rapidly down in temperature down to about 0.1 Kelvin. Okay, so we're now at about a little below 0.1 Kelvin.
Question? Yep. Fluctuations that are much smaller than that, obviously.
So these are actually physical temperature fluctuations at the 100 millikelvin stage. And you should ask, you know, how does that affect the instrument? 20 nanokelvin per root second is much smaller than 30 microkelvin detector noise. But on the other hand, as we mentioned, we should be able to get down to, you know, nanokelvins at the end of the mission at a low L if all goes well. So you should ask that question. It's a good question to ask. And we have started. One thing about data is you can plot, you know, anything you want versus anything. So we make power spectrum of one thing versus another thing. We do cross correlations. You do see it, but it's not, as far as we can tell at this point, it's not a significant statistically significant at the systematic level, which is mixing two terms together. You have sort of a noise level in the temperature, which is has some structure, time structure in it, and then you're measuring on the sky, which has another time structure. If those two are somehow phase locked together, you would be in trouble. But there's no reason for them to be phase locked, and they are not. Okay, so it's going to add noise, but the noise is much smaller than detector noise. We don't think that's an issue at all. There are other things that become issues that we have to worry about a little bit, but that's not one of them. Okay, any other questions?
Yeah, was there any thought about restocking the helium-3? Or is, are there other things that would cause it to shut off after about that period of time?
No. So, that's a good question. Let's go back. The cost of helium-3, okay. The U.S. and the Russians, which are the two primary contributors to helium-3, which comes from tritium decay, are decommissioning a lot of nuclear weapons. Helium-3 comes from the tritium in fusion weapons. There was a glut on the market for a while when the Russians decommissioned a lot of weapons, so the price of helium-3 dropped about $100 or less per liter. Planck bought up a huge amount of helium-3 at that time, and the current price of helium-3 is above $2,000, so it went up a factor 20 from the low. Okay, so if you multiply $20 times 36,000, $2,000 times $36,000, you realize there's almost $100 million of helium-3 out there. That's a lot. And in fact, if that were the price, say the mission would have a serious problem. Because the entire mission cost is of the order of, you know, $500-600 million. If you have $100 million of helium-3, that's a huge hit. So actually, there's a crisis at the moment in the entire cryogenics field because of that problem. So could you go out and refill the helium-3? In theory, yes. But the problem is you got to get there, and getting out to L2. Is not like going up in shuttle. You'd have to get out there and refill it. So there's no, I would say, yes, in theory it's possible, but in practice there's no possible way to do that, okay, given our existing technology. Now, if you could do that, is there anything else on board which limits it? The cooling system could just die at any point. This is a mechanical refrigerator. It could die. We don't know what the ultimate lifetime is going to be. It's hopefully going to be many years, but I don't think it's going to be 20 years. Okay. There's a second issue, which is the 20 Kelvin hydrogen sorption cooler is degrading with time, and we knew it would degrade with time. We knew that long ago. We don't know how long we can run it for. We're hoping we can run it for of order 3 years or so. There are some other things on board which are also expendables, some propellants and stuff. But the helium-3 is probably going to go first and take out the bolometers. The low-frequency instrument can continue to run as long as this runs and this runs. We don't need the helium-3 for that. So. That could go another N years. How long N is, you know, we're not sure. Could we get out to, you know, 9 years like WMAP? Good question. I'll come back to that question in a bit.
So there really aren't any practical alternatives to helium-3 for future missions?
For future missions. Well, there is a crisis at the moment, literally. Because you can't even if you had $2,000 per liter, you can't buy it because they... DH&S basically steps in and says this is, you know, a national security item at this point. So there is a problem. We don't quite know how to solve the problem. We're voting for more thermonuclear weapons. We'd like to ramp up the production. So actually, there's a serious discussion going on in the cosmology community of just making our own thermonuclear weapons. Why not? It puts us in a much more powerful position when it comes to negotiating budgets. Personally, I'm all in favor of it. There is not an answer to that question at the moment. We don't know how to resolve that, but I would hope that it can be resolved. There are other things besides helium-3 which are good neutron detectors, but convincing DH&S to go that direction is not here. Anyway, whatever. So it's just getting late. So this is a picture. Here's the bolometer array, and then here's the low-frequency array. We made everything gold because gold at this level of investment is cheap and looks nice and doesn't corrode and blah, blah. So when we talk about future missions, there's of order 100 horns of order, okay? It's possible now to imagine missions that are 10 times that, so 1,000 detectors, and then we could do 10,000 detectors. Going to 1,000,000 detectors is tough because each detector is separated. Here, they're separated more than they need to be, but each detector gets separated by order of a wavelength or so. You can't cram in too much tighter than that. So if you want to put a million detectors in, it's 1,000 by 1,000, you're getting up into enormous focal planes. It's possible, but a megapixel detector is not on the drawing board at this point for these wavelengths. Okay, just some technical slides. Radiation comes in here after it hits the mirrors, rattles down here, goes through some filters, comes down, ends up on a silicon nitride mesh, which we actually, these were made at JPL. We actually make similar ones here in the UCSB clean room. Some of the devices are polarization sensitive, which you, I guess you can kind of see. There's a grid pattern that goes this way, and there's a grid pattern that goes that way. So we can measure polarization. This grid pattern does not measure polarization. So they're both polarized detectors and unpolarized detectors on board. Okay, there's 36 feed horns in this instrument, 52 bolometers, because some of them have polarized detectors. They have two in one. Okay. Here's what they look like on the sky. Here's 143 gigahertz, 857, which I apologize you can't see. There's 545 gigahertz, 353, 217, and 100 gigahertz. The cleanest science bands for this detector will be the 100 and the 143. These others will be very good at ferreting out the dust. Okay, there's all kinds of other stuff that's going to come out shortly with the HFI science. There's SC galaxies. There's just galaxies in general we're going to detect. We already have maps that show all kinds of stuff. And I'll show you a couple of maps in a moment, but nothing to be very excited about. So we expect to see of order tens of thousands of galaxies. With COBE, we basically saw almost nothing in terms of foreground sources besides our galaxy. We saw a few things, but not much, handful. WMAP sees a few, again, few handfuls, but nothing really serious. We're going to see tens of thousands. So there's the LFI instrument on board, which is an array of 30 to 70 gigahertz transistor-based detectors, similar to WMAP, but more sensitive. And here we'll get down to of order. This is about 200 something microkelvin per root second, and we'll get down to about 8 microkelvin per half degree pixel. Okay. So we map the sky in a very simplistic way. We basically just paint onto the sky as this thing rotates. Here's the beams. We rotate once per minute, approximately, and then we shift over about 1 degree per day as the Earth goes around the Sun in 1 year. Sky coverage at 100 gigahertz, and they all look pretty similar. This is for a nominal 15-month mission. Pretty confident at this point, we can do 30-plus months, unless something breaks in between. We have to get permission to do this. We feel that the science arguments are extremely strong to do as much as you can, because it's the only... Well, the 30 months is going to be limited by helium-3. But the LFI, the low-frequency instrument, can keep going as long as the coolers work. So 30 months is the limit. At the current rate that we're burning, it's the wrong term, that we're exhausting helium-3, we'll run out of helium-3 in about 30 months. That'll shut down the bolometers. The LFI can go until the cryocoolers quit and other expendables go. So we, maybe another couple of years. Our hope is that they'll last to at least 30 months.
But why do they not allow you to do as much as the instrument can do? What does that even mean? You can't keep taking data from
it? We got to keep the lights on. You know, it's you got to pay the people to run the ground station and you got to pay people to analyze data, you know. But it's better to keep us off the streets rather than incarcerate us. I mean, frankly, you know, it's cheaper. So. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's especially, you know, think of you. Would you want string theorists running around? I mean, it'd be scary. Right? It's better to keep you here. Okay. It seems, you know, like a no-brainer to us. And given that there's not going to be another space-based mission for a long, long time, it seems crazy to turn off. Still, we're only approved for 14 months at this point. So we're asking for an extension. I suspect they would see the light and see that it doesn't make sense to turn off. I think most people would say it'd be crazy. Okay, well, so you send data from the instrument to the ground, and it gets sent out to various places. The Planck resolution compared to the COBE resolution is obviously much finer. Forget all this, all right, whatever. You know that you decompose, the way we do things is we decompose the sky into YLMs, and then if we assume that the M's are not correlated, then we can produce a power spectrum of CL versus L. And we have some very nice power spectra already. But remember, this assumption is based on Gaussianity, effectively a random phase, which you don't want to make that assumption. And we know this guy is not Gaussian at the level which you see things like galaxies. It's definitely not Gaussian. Okay, so, right, you can say, whoa, okay, cool data, thanks for showing me. Yeah, well, it's not. This is data, this is simulation. So,
simulation of how much, 1 year?
Yeah, this is 1 year. I think this is 4 years. There's this draconian rule that, you know, I can only show you what I'm authorized to show you. You can't believe how much crap we take. One of the Reino Mendeleza gave a talk at CERN, which was videotaped. Someone put it on YouTube. Someone took the YouTube and then analyzed the data and published the paper. That's serious. And so this just caused endless, you know, people are just.
Well, you guys had a strip.
They're paranoid.
You published the first light strip and people are
going. Yeah, and I'll show you the first light strip in a moment. Yeah, I mean, people are. Well, I mean, it makes sense to me, but whatever. So I can only show you, I wish I could show you other things, but no, whatever. Okay, so these are simulations of what we should achieve in temperature and polarization. So we should just do a bang-up job in temperature and a bang-up job in polarization. We should see the reionization bump, and we should see just amazing structure in the polarization. And that's even, we're doing better than this shows. And if we get a 30-month mission, we'll do even better. Okay, so just for comparison, here's the WMAP 1 sigma. This is probably, I think this is 4 year. We haven't updated to the 9 year, so take off another factor, root 2 there, a little more than root 2. But we should just do an incredible job. Now, what about B modes? Well, if you could tell me what the B mode prediction is, I could help you. But of course, you want me to tell you what the B mode data is, so neither of us want to really answer that. But we will tell you what we get for B modes at some point. And I'll tell you what that point will be soon. All right, so unfortunately, Planck is so sensitive that the you know, I put before you a blessing and a curse, and the blessing is the instrument's really good. The curse is that there's a lot of stuff between us and the CMB. So we have the CMB, we're going to have thermal SZ, we're going to have kinetic SZ, you're going to have all kinds of galaxies, both radio and infrared, dusty galaxies. You're going to have free emission from our galaxy, you're going to have synchrotron radiation from the galaxy, you're going to have dust from our galaxy, and you're going to have the detector noise. And you got to take all that into account before you produce the CMB maps. So, of course, one of the things you want to know are what are these cosmological parameters, and probably the one that you're really interested in is this one. You probably don't care very much about the other ones at this point. Well, you want to know R, obviously. And you'd probably, if more detailed people want to know what tau is, but you really want to know what the spectral index is, and you want to know what R is. Okay, so this is the first 2 weeks of data. We now have we have a whole sky plus. So, and all I can tell you is it's just unbelievably amazing. It's really incredible. This doesn't do it justice at all. Well, let me show you some other pretty pictures.
When will the first paper doing cosmological parameter estimation appear?
Yeah, and I'll actually answer that in a moment. Okay. Thank you for asking that question. I'll remind and pay you afterwards, okay. So here's the just some pretty pictures from 30 gigahertz to about 900 gigahertz crossing the galactic plane. You can see less bright at 70, sort of comparable between 70 and 100. This is that trough that I showed you before. 143, it's actually a little deceptive because it is quite deceptive, actually. This is a little bit brighter, even though it doesn't look like it. And then as you come up in frequency, you can see things increase dramatically. Okay. So this is a high galactic latitude region where there should be very little galactic contamination. This is 70 and 100. And you can see they're quite well correlated, which they should be. And it looks just great. This was released last week. This is a really pretty picture. We were impressed when we looked at what they did with the data. They didn't Photoshop it, but they made it artistic, and it's beautiful. So this is a picture of the sort of 857 gigahertz data, which is useless for the CMB. So that's why we released it, because you can't do anything with the CMB here. But you can see all these beautiful dust emission regions. So this is a galactic plane. This is a coordinate system in galactic coordinates. Here's the galactic equator. Here's the poles. So the CMB, the really clean CMB regions, would be out here. All right.
Can you learn about dust actually help supernovae people understand to what extent dust is influencing their observations?
Yes and no. So we do measure dust, which is similar. Well, basically, it's the same dust. But the problem is you have to know what the emissivity of the dust is, or the absorption coefficient of dust. And you can model dust based on long wavelength measurements to get short wavelength measurements. So one answer is yes, but that's probably not the ideal way to get to where they want to be. It's probably better to look in the near infrared and then sort of map it out from maybe a few microns down to, you know, half a micron or so. That's probably a better way. But people will you know, obviously you take data, you don't want to throw it away, so this helps a bit. But I don't think it's the ideal way to get at that answer. Looking at extinction at, you know, say 600 nanometers by looking at emission at a millimeter, it's a big stretch. Okay, there's a schedule, which I actually couldn't show you, but there's also a nice outreach effort here, which some of it's being done next door at the CNSI Allosphere. Anyway, we get some 600 billion samples, and then 600 billion is of order 10 to a theorist, so we just take this and we cook it down like a wine sauce down into of order 10-20 numbers. And of course, one of the things you really want to know about is, do we have evidence for inflation from the B modes? And whatever, you've seen all this stuff before, so I won't go there. So Planck is not the ideal instrument to measure B modes with. I'll just tell you a couple things about this. Planck is not designed as a polarimeter. We do measure polarization. And there's no reason to believe at this point that we won't get down to our fundamental limits in polarization. But if you're going specifically after polarization, Planck is not what any of us would have designed specifically. And we didn't go into this designing it specifically for that purpose. So there are probably more effective ways to go after that. However, we should get down to an R of around 0.05 or 0.03 or so with Planck at low L's. At higher L, the problem is that we're covering the entire sky. So it's not the optimal way to run a polarimeter if you want to get low L, low high sensitivity at modest L. We'll do really well at low L, which is where it's actually quite important. In terms of an R, we should get down to around 0.05, maybe a little bit less. The goal, of course, well, one goal is you'd like to know what N sub S is. Now, we'll measure N sub S. This is, okay, it's a little unfair. This is 4 years versus 1 year Planck, so it should be 9 years versus, say, 2.5 years of Planck. So they're in a scale sort of similar in fractional, but fractional sensitivity, well, it's not. Fractional errors, it's not quite that simple. N sub S we should know to much less than 1%. So if N sub S is 0.96, you know, we'll know that 0.96 with an error which is, you know, plus and minus point, well, the formal error is going to be 0.002. It probably is not going to be quite that good, but nonetheless, if it's 0.96, we'll measure it as being different from 1. Well, simulations, yeah. So if it were different from unity, yes, the red is the error circle from 1 year Planck. And there's various, so there's tau, omega baryon, you know, whatever. We've got all kinds of things there. So we're just going to do, I think, an amazing job at parameter extraction. I mean, it's just, the maps are just really phenomenal. Some of us who have been doing this for a long time really just sit and drool over the data. I mean, it's that good. There are some gotchas. I'm serious. I mean, sometimes we just sit around and look at the monitor and say, oh my goodness, you know, it's freaking amazing. And then we go back to work. But there are some gotchas, and the gotchas are very important to us and will be important to you. So to answer your question, okay, jump ahead here. So we have one full sky survey finished. We get one sky survey every 7 months. Hopefully they'll allow us to get 4 more, maybe 5. Depends. We're not exactly sure when the helium 3 is going to run out. We're trying to run at as low a rate as we can. So vote yes on Prop P, okay, if you get a chance. Leave the lights on, okay? And if you take me out, you know, maybe. Okay, Planck's even more sensitive than expected by a non-trivial factor, actually. So here's some interesting, I don't mean to demean anybody, particularly myself, but Planck's about 20 times more sensitive than WMAP. That means that 1 year of Planck is about 400 years of WMAP. Okay, so, but it's even much greater than that because the beam size, we have a much smaller beam size. So it's even more, it's even higher reconstruction sensitivity at higher L. Okay, so a 2.5 year mission is about a millennium on WMAP. Not to, you know, stick it to anybody, but, and then, you know, I could show you the next mission, which could be, you know, 10 times more sensitive than Planck, and so we'll say the same thing. But well, I like playing this numbers game. I should have been a bookie. Planck was about 200 times more sensitive than we had on COBE, and so 1 year Planck is worth about 40,000 years on COBE. Okay, Planck is photon statistics limited, so this is very important. You can't do better per detector. The only way to do better is add more detectors and go for, you know.
Can I ask you what
yes.
The beam was? I mean, there are these foregrounds, whether or not the inflationary scale is high enough to so
yes.
To understand, you do expect to see beam modes.
Oh.
But the question of whether they're
real, yeah, whether they're cosmological or not. Yeah. I mean, if you want to really ask the real serious questions are, can we clean the foregrounds well enough to say that we get down to what we should theoretically get down to in terms of statistics, will we get there just based on systematics? And I don't know the answer to that. None of us can say yet what the answer is.
I understand. Nobody's seen a beam mode from foregrounds or not.
There definitely are beam modes from foregrounds.
Right.
Okay. We are not currently limited by that yet, but we haven't looked deeply enough to know. No one has looked on the whole sky to answer that question. On small patches of the sky, down to a level of, you know, R of 0.15 or so, the foregrounds do not appear to be a limit. Okay. Now, whether you can go another factor 10 lower, we don't know. And one of the reasons we're also anxious to look at the Planck data, not just the Planck team, but other people are, is what can you conclude on large scales if you wanted to go another factor 10 or 100 lower? And we don't know the answer to that. And that's one of the reasons to push this to the end. If you want to have the next generation instrument and you find that you're killed already, then you're going to have to rethink the whole scenario. And of course, the really unfortunate part is somewhat like, I think, the axion issue is we don't know what the answer is even supposed to be. So, you know, would you be tremendously upset if R was 10 to the minus 4? And as a theorist, as far as I could tell and talk to my theoretical friends, I mean, they don't want to depress me, so they say, here, take some Prozac and then I'll tell you, no, I'm not. I have a theory that produces 10 to the minus 6. I said, I told you so. Okay. So I don't know. I think we're very interested in holding this dialogue as if we put a limit of 0.05 on R, what does that tell you fundamentally? Would you say, yeah, no big deal? We knew from the measurements of delta T that if we got down to 10 to the minus 6 and we didn't measure something, we'd have to radically revise the whole theory of structure formation. But if you get to 0.001 with R, which we're not going to get to, would you have to radically revise ideas of early universe?
Roughly 0.01 is a significant, you don't have to radically revise anything, but it's telling you about the range of the amplitude relative to the Planck scale. So it's an interesting.
But if you got 10 to the minus 10, there are 1,000 papers out there with very well established models that would just say fine.
Yeah, see, this is. So this is.
It's an interesting measurement
or. Oh, I agree.
Either way.
I agree. And so this is the dialogue I would really like to have with you. This is the honest dialogue, which obviously we'd like to do the measurement, because if you don't do the measurement, you don't know where you're going to be. The problem is to convince the funding agents to spend $1 billion to get something the theorists will yawn about.
Well, we don't yawn. So because there's a threshold of 0.01 between a super or sub-Planckian field range, we are interested in the result either way. A negative result is interesting, a positive result is interesting. So.
I realize it's interesting, and I'm actually very interested in the dialogue on this. The question is, how interesting is it? Is it $1 billion interesting?
No one would think you've killed inflation if you get down to 0.01 and don't see.
Yeah,
it,
so.
Honest,
so
nobody would say.
But you see, it's
right.
a threshold.
So the question is, how expensive is it to get down there if you know you can't go further?
Yeah, it's of order $1 billion. Now, there are other ways to do this. So we think that if the foregrounds are kind to us, that we could probably get to 0.01 with a combination of ground and balloon-borne missions long before we fly a space-based mission. Now, that's assuming that the foregrounds are kind to us. We have enough detectors to fly. We're rapidly advancing detector technology. We can fly sort of 1,000 to 10,000 detectors now. And as I showed you, the atmosphere in a balloon is good enough, it looks like, to get to where we want to be. Now, is the other parts of this systematic error in hand? We don't know. Okay, but this is a serious question. The review committees are not stupid. You know, they know that it's going to cost $1 billion to run a space mission, roughly, or 500 million to a billion. And they want to know if these missions are going to return nothing but a limit on the inflaton, do they want to spend the money? And how important is that? And so I would only ask for an honest discussion of this.
Yeah, I think all we're saying is it's not a random point in parameter space. This 0.01 is a significant point. However, as Shama said, it's not going to decide whether inflation was correct or not.
Right.
Can you imagine a mission that gets up to cosmic variance limits, the CMB, for the last time up to some reasonably large L?
Well,
I mean,
okay.
It's a finite problem. You can just do it the best you can.
So there's two issues here. One is the question of random field. You know, is it truly nothing but a random field? And of course, if you presuppose that, then you could go ahead and run that calculation. So, you know, already Planck is going to be, quote, cosmic variance limited up to, you know, L of, Dirk, whatever the number, you know, probably 1,500, 2,000, something like that. It's going to be very good. Let me continue this dialogue because I think this is incredibly important. This is the best thing I could do in the time we have here and in the next. How long is your workshop going on for?
Well, it's a few months. This week is a little over
this week. Yeah, okay. But then over the next couple months, I would love to have a serious discussion of how much impact would it be to get to 0.01, 0.005, 0.001.
So have you read the CMB poll literature?
Yes.
Because
The problem is it's very slanted on wanting to do something. My interest is more fundamental, which is I'm not pushing an agenda. I want to understand the real how this would push theory.
Okay, we can definitely talk.
Okay. All right.
By the way, Charlie Crowe is going to come down and talk about some dedicated B mode experiments.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the way to go. There are B modes that experiments should get to 0.01.
Okay.
Right. Do you anticipate strong competition from balloon based experiments before a constraint like 0.05?
Well, Planck already has essentially that now. I'm not saying that we have, I'm not going to quote you a number. I'm just saying the data is already in the can. And every 7 months, we get more data in the can.
And the foreground cleaning that you need to get those kind of constraints is not a year-long project. It's just a matter of...
Well, okay. This is not a trivial discussion because what we know so far is that on small patches of the sky, it's relatively clean. At the sort of 0.15, 0.2 level for R. We don't know as you continue to go down how that's going to degrade. With Planck, we didn't design as a polarimeter. We're going to have issues that we have to contend with on the systematic side, not talking about external sources, talking about instrumental sides. We didn't design as a polarimeter. It's not the optimum polarimeter. Okay, I think the right way to approach this is to push as hard as you can from the ground and from balloons before you even attempt to go to space. That's my personal opinion. It's not the opinion of others necessarily in the field. It's my personal opinion. Because I don't know what we're shooting for theoretically. And I know that review committees are not going to dump $1 billion on us if we can't say this is just going to radically overthrow the theoretical framework for early universe physics.
Well, could you just wait for a hint from balloons before you try to make the case?
Well, that's absolutely. And that's what we, you know, we're hoping, and we could just do it. It's not very hard for us to actually get you data that hints at something. It's very simple, right? I mean, it's quite trivial. Yeah, I mean, you saw the hint of, you know, of dark matter, right? You know, it was 1 sigma, so cool, right? You know, more money. Well, okay, I don't know. So, you know, how low do we need to go, right? If we're random phase, then cosmic variance limit. So, then we can answer that question. But we know that we're not random phase when you include all these foregrounds. There's no way. Okay, the sky is much more complex, okay? You know, there's lensing, for example, which produces B modes, right? So, I don't know, how many peaks do you want? You know, I mean, okay, there's probably going to be a lot of peaks. Okay, can't tell you many, but there's going to be a lot of peaks. Okay, is n sub s different from 1? At least that would be a reasonable number to shoot for. I mean, that you should say, hey, if n sub s is different from 1, then maybe we have a shot at concocting a theory that predicts r. Right, and you know, in the simplistic models, I think it's roughly 5 times, you know, the difference, roughly. I mean, I don't know, that's very model dependent, so I'd love to talk to you about that. We're going to have an error on n sub s, which is much less than 1%. So, okay, so to answer your question. So, we've been told we can't publish scientific papers, really meaningful cosmological scientific papers, until probably late 2011. Now, our hand can be forced, you know, but... And the data on the chart is supposed to be released in 2012 to the community. Okay, but then I found a Mayan bolometer. So they actually had bolometers a long time ago.
So you don't even know the answer yet, right? There's some sort of unbiased analysis.
Or are we going to open the box?
Yeah,
to quote the CDM people? CMS, sorry. We operate a bit differently than that. We don't do the sort of open box method. What we're doing is going through and trying to understand all the errors, including foregrounds, radio galaxies, source counts. These are things which anyone has to do. We already have maps, we already have power spectra. We could just, you know, kind of vomit it on the community if we wanted to. But, you know, what, and which would be an interesting stimulus to the community, but it's not really what we should do because it's too complicated now. If we're like COBE, then we could show you a power spectrum right now and have absolute confidence that that's the right power spectrum. We could give you the parameter estimations pretty much right now. But that's not the case that we're in. The case that we're in is the sky is really much more complex. And we knew we'd be in this case, and we just didn't know how much more complicated it was going to be. And I'm not saying it's more complex than we thought it was going to be, but we didn't have an a priori theory to say this is what the sky is. If it's that, we're done. Because we don't know what it's going to look like. It's very non-Gaussian. There's all kinds of crap out there. There's just tens of thousands of things to worry about. Literally, there are tens of thousands of compact sources out there. How all those will fall out in terms of getting to things that you're really interested in, you know, what is R, what is N sub S? N sub S, you know, we could probably answer, and I would love to be able to quote N sub S to you. You know, at least to tell you if it's different from one, I'd love to be able to quote that. I mean, I don't think that's asking too much.
And how many sigma could you quote it?
Well, it depends on what it is. As I mentioned, the formal error on N sub S, if you just look at the blue book, you know, is going to be of order, you know, 0.002, 0.005. If N sub S is 0.96, we will be, you know, way more than 10 sigma significant. Now, the answer to that does not require as much understanding of the sky complexity. So, you know, if it were up to me, I would try to answer it.
Pardon? Because you have so many peaks.
Yeah. But on the other hand, there's a significant push to try to do it right. And right means it takes longer. And, you know, I'm as frustrated as you are because I mean, literally, you know, I think it'd be reasonable to show people maps. Oh, look, it works, you know, and all they let us show you is, you know, this kind of stupid stuff. This is pretty nice, right? That looks nice. And that looks nice. You know, that looks nice. But, you know, what you really want, you don't want this. You want a power spectrum based on this, right? You say, look, you show us the map, just give us the power spectrum. That's a reasonable question, you know, but I can't do it. And that's not going to happen, at least formally, until late 2011. The good news is that we already have one sky, one full sky. So if nothing else, if the experiment, you know, takes a crap tomorrow, if the 4K cooler dies, the instrument's gone. That's it. Everything is gone. Both detector sets are completely toast. And there's a piston going up and down like this, you know, about 60 times a second. You know, if that thing dies, that's it. The whole thing's toast. But we already have one full sky. So this is already worth hundreds of years of WMAP data at the present time. And much, much more so because of more frequency coverage, more angular resolution. So there's no indication, there's no fundamental indication that any of the cryogenics, which is really what we're depend on, is going to die anytime soon. It could always, you know, the cooler could seize. Okay. But I think there's reasonable expectation we'll get 30 months. And then we know we're going to run out of helium-3. Then the question is, you know, okay, we should be able to answer this question at the level of less than a percent. And we should be able to give you R, assuming the foregrounds can be taken out, to 0.05 or better at low L, not at higher L. We're not going to see the lensing signature. Well, we might see the lensing signature, but we're not going to see much in between the very low L and, say, the lensing signature. I'm frustrated. But we should do at least this well, and this was based on what we thought we would get in sensitivity for one year. If we go to 2.5 years, we'll do root 2.5 better. And as I mentioned, the detectors are working better than we thought. So it's already going to be, it should be incredibly impressive. It's not the optimal way to get to the inflation signature, in my opinion. Okay. Now, there could be other things. You could get non-Gaussianity out of the CMB. You could get some sort of signature there. If I were you, I would love to hold a discussion of what's the optimal way to look for inflation. Is the CMB the right way? Is it, you know, something like the Big Bang Observatory looking for gravity waves directly? I don't know. I'd love to hold a, you know, some sort of talk about that if you guys want to, you know, sort of shoot the breeze on that. And for me, who has to deal with people in review committees, how important is it that you get to 0.001 versus technologically going much below 0.001 is a huge stretch for us. Just even 0.001 in R, sorry. For us to get to 0.001 in R with a future mission, not with this mission, is just going to be incredibly difficult. So if you said to us, it doesn't really make much difference, then...
Again, 0.01 makes a difference.
Well, I think you'll get to 0.01 if the foregrounds are not too nasty, probably within 5 to 10 years. Combination Planck plus suborbital missions. You don't have to get to an orbital mission, we don't think, to get to 0.01. Now that's a function of whether the foregrounds are nice to us. The advantage of an orbital mission is you can go to much higher frequencies and clean the dust. So.
Well, again, we'll have a talk on that on Thursday.
Say again.
We'll have a Thursday.
Yes, yeah. Well, if you just crunch the numbers, you should be able to get to 0.01 with the sort of next generation of ground-based plus balloon-borne experiments. Okay, but that's a statistical only answer, not a systematics answer. All right, well, I kept you a long time. You've been very patient. Happy answering any other questions except what's the answer. Mm-hmm. Yes.
The other thing that a lot of us are interested in is, of course, the non-Gaussianity issue. And
yeah.
You didn't really talk about that.
Yeah. So one of the problems with non-Gaussianity is that all the foregrounds are non-Gaussian by their very nature. And because we don't know how